Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today on our Capitol Report, we'll address the burning question of whether or not a sitting president of the United States can be indicted for a criminal offense. And we'll share revelations by the New York Times about a long secret memo by former special counsel Kenneth Starr, who investigated Clinton during the Whitewater scandal, addressing that very subject. We'll also have an update on lawsuits filed against President Trump's Election Integrity Commission. In local news, we'll tell you how a gun owner's PAC scored a victory with the Santee City Council. And then, our newsmaker interview today is with Josh Butner. He's a Navy SEAL, a Democrat, a member of the Hamul Dulzura School Board, and he's running for Congress against Representative Duncan Hunter. And finally, we'll have an update on the Lost Fire burning in the Warner Springs area. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. As the special investigation into Trump's Russia ties proceeds, the question of whether or not a president can be indicted while in office has arisen. Now, the New York Times has obtained a secret memo prepared by Ken Starr, independent counsel during the Bill Clinton presidency, which concluded that it is, quote, proper, constitutional, and legal for a federal grand jury to indict a sitting president for serious criminal acts that are not part of and are contrary to the president's official duties, unquote. In addition, an earlier 1974 memo, written for Watergate special counsel Leon Jaworski, similarly found that he could legally indict President Richard Nixon. Now, in both the Nixon and Clinton cases, the prosecutors chose to allow Congress to instigate impeachment proceedings instead of filing indictments. Nixon resigned when presented with impeachment papers. Clinton was impeached by the House, but was not convicted in a Senate trial. The Starr memo kept locked away in the National Archives until the New York Times obtained it through a Freedom of Information Act request this week, suggests that current Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's options could include seeking indictments against Trump if his investigation finds evidence of crimes such as collusion with Russia over the election or money laundering at Trump casinos, for example, if Trump himself had knowledge of any such activities. Now, in fact, the New York Times also learned that Ken Starr actually had prosecutors prepare a draft indictment against President Clinton before Congress decided to impeach on grounds of perjury related to his affair with Monica Lewinsky. The content of that draft indictment has never been made public, although the Times has requested the document and is seeking to determine if disclosure would be allowed under grand jury secrecy rules. Mueller's authority as special prosecutor is broad. The Justice Department order establishing the special prosecutor allows him to pursue anything uncovered as a result of his investigation into the Trump campaign Russia ties, even if unrelated to the Russian issues. Now, this is similar to what occurred during the Clinton investigation, which began as a probe of Clinton's investments in the Whitewater Development Corporation. Although no actions were ever taken against Clinton in the Whitewater probe, that investigation did lead to discovery of his affair with a White House intern and his subsequent impeachment trial for perjury after he lied under oath to hide the liaison. An effort to indict a sitting president would almost certainly face a court challenge, but there is no constitutional prohibition on such matters. Indeed, the 25th Amendment could be invoked to allow a vice president to temporarily take power if a president were unable to carry out his duties temporarily while on trial. The Washington Post has reported that President Trump is said to be weighing whether he can pardon close allies or family members for crimes not yet named, or even potentially pardon himself. Now, Trump's attorney called that nonsense. But President Trump himself confirmed that he's had discussions on pardons in one of his tweets, stating, While all agree the U.S. president has the complete power to pardon, why think of that when only crime so far is leaks against us, fake news? There is far from agreement that presidents have complete power to pardon. And in fact, a president's power to issue pardons does have limits. In fact, the Constitution itself states that the president can only issue pardons for federal crimes, not state crimes, and any crimes related to impeachment are exempt. One congressman has already filed impeachment papers against the president on obstruction of justice charges, so at minimum, any accountability for obstruction of justice actions by the president or others could not be erased through a pardon. A pardon also does not cover crimes not yet committed. So if someone committed perjury during future testimony, for instance, that would not be included under a pardon issued previously. Legal opinions are mixed on whether a president could pardon himself for crimes unrelated to impeachment, with some arguing that such action would be a clear conflict of interest. Any such action would clearly be challenged and would likely wind up decided by the Supreme Court. A president could resign, however, and obtain a pardon once a vice president is elevated to the presidency, as occurred when Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon. The accountability questions could ultimately be resolved for the future by congressional action to enforce laws setting limits on presidential pardons to avoid criminal prosecution of himself, his cabinet, his campaign officials, or his family, as well as, potentially, limits on the power of a vice president elevated to the presidency to pardon a predecessor. But that would take a Congress with backbone, willing to stand up and put country before party.
Multiple lawsuits have been filed against Donald Trump's Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. In addition, critics voice concerns that the commission's true aim may be voter suppression, not protecting voter integrity. One suit has been filed by the American Civil Liberties Union, making clear that the commission held its first meeting in secrecy with no public notice. Teresa Lee, staff attorney with the ACLU, says this raises serious concerns about the credibility and intent of the commission. What are they trying to hide? She asks. Other lawsuits object to the commission's sweeping request for private data on voters from all 50 states, including names, addresses, phone numbers, party registration, and the last four digits of Social Security numbers, which are often used as default passwords for commercial services. A lawsuit filed by Electronic Privacy Information says the commission took no steps to protect the privacy of sensitive information and asserts that the action would increase risks of privacy to millions of registered voters, including military families whose home addresses would be revealed. The suit alleges this would undermine integrity of the federal election system. The lawsuit calls making such private information public both without precedent and crazy. Most state officials agree. To date, 48 states, including California, have refused to turn over all or at least part of their voter data to the commission. In several states, outrage by voters has led mass numbers of people to unregister to vote. Requests to be removed from voting rolls shot up by 2,150% in Denver, Colorado, for example, after news of the commission's request for private voter data was publicized. ACLU Voting Rights Project Director Dale Ho calls the entire commission a sham due to appointment of Chris Kobach as vice chair. Kobach has a dark history of various voter suppression tactics as former Kansas Secretary of State. The Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law has documented that Kobach has also supported President Trump's totally unsubstantiated claim that millions of fraudulent votes were cast in the 2016 presidential election. Kobach himself made similar false claims of large numbers of undocumented voters casting votes, even though a decade of research found the rate of voting by non-citizens to be almost non-existent, only around 1/1000th of 1%. Out of 42 jurisdictions studied by the Brennan Center, 40 of them could not find a single case of a non-citizen voting in the 2016 election. Most nefariously, Kobach created the Interstate Voter Registration Cross-Check Database that claimed it would purge duplicate voters off the rolls. It was used in 27 states with Republican secretaries of state in the 2016 election. According to investigative reporter Greg Palast, it was used to purge 7 million voters off the rolls, predominantly African American, Asian, and Hispanic voters. Palast tracked down many of the voters purged searched and learned that they were not double voters. In some cases, people with the same first and last names, but different middle names, were purged, for example. Or people with common Latino names in different states were removed off voting rolls, with no effort made to determine whether the names were the same person or different people. The margin of purged voters through cross-check was more than enough to hand Trump victory over Hillary Clinton in key swing states, according to Palast. In Michigan, where Trump won by just over 13,000 votes, cross-check purged nearly 450,000 people off the rolls. In Arizona, where over 270,000 were removed off voter rolls, Trump's margin of victory was just over 85,000 votes. And in North Carolina, Trump won by about 177,000 votes, yet roughly three times that many people, over 589,000, were prevented from voting by the cross-check software that Kobach created. Salon.com, in an article alleging election rigging involving Kobach, asked, "Why is it more relevant to focus on a crazed and completely unsubstantiated and untrue allegation about 3 million illegal aliens voting, but not a claim by a fellow journalist that 7 million American citizens weren't allowed to have their votes counted?" Multiple Democratic lawmakers have sent an 11-page letter to Vice President Mike Pence, who chairs the commission. The lawmakers oppose the commission's request for private voter data, which the congressional members state is unprecedented by any federal entity. They object to the commission's secrecy and sweeping request for private voter data. The lawmakers' letter further states, "The commission would better serve American voters if it focused on the growth of voter suppression laws that have spread since the Supreme Court undermined the protections of the Voting Rights Act," noting that in 2017 alone, at least 99 bills restricting access to registration and voting have been introduced in 31 states, while the number of polling places has been reduced in many places. In addition, the letter asserts many states have imposed restrictive voter ID requirements despite discriminatory impacts on voters on the basis of race and other protected characteristics. The letter from congressional members includes an extensive document request from the commission and ends with this pointed statement: "The commission should explore increasing access to voting, not perpetuating the false and damaging notion that massive voter fraud exists in our nation's elections." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Santee's City Council, after hearing testimony from gun owners, voted unanimously to send a letter to Sheriff Bill Gore asking him to change his policy on concealed weapons permits. Recently, the California Supreme Court upheld Sheriff Gore's policy of limiting concealed carry permits only to citizens who can show good cause, such as an imminent threat to their safety. State law already requires that applicants pass a criminal background check and take a class on firearms safety, but members of the San Diego County Gun Owners PAC convinced the council to ask Sheriff Gore to accept as good cause a desire for self-defense or personal protection, which many other jurisdictions already allow. More permissive concealed carry policies have been opposed by groups concerned over gun violence, and in some places, notably states with less rigorous background checks, concealed weapons have been used to commit violent crimes such as murder, rape, and robbery. But Michael Schwartz, executive director of the Gun Owners PAC, told council, "The ability for people to protect their life, their family, and their dignity when they leave their home should be a choice everyone can make." Santee resident Barbara Starr, a veteran who has worked in law enforcement in the military, told council she was denied a permit by the sheriff because she did not show good cause. She stated, "I currently work late-night shifts, and I would like to be able to defend myself." The Santee City Council agreed, with members voicing support for Second Amendment rights and the ability of law-abiding, trained individuals to have a concealed weapons permit. Schwartz said he hopes to see other cities in the county entertain motions similar to the one adopted by Santee, adding, "The right to keep and bear arms is about protection of yourself, your family, and your dignity." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Josh Buttner. Josh is a former lieutenant commander in the Navy SEALs. He served for 23 years in the U.S. Navy, including combat deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. Currently, he is serving as an elected trustee on the Humboldt-Ulzura School Board. He comes from a military family with service dating back to the Civil War. He lives on a ranch in Hamul where he's raised his children, including a son who is continuing the family tradition, currently serving in the military. And now, Josh is one of six Democrats running for Congress in the 50th Congressional District against Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter, who is currently under investigation by the Justice Department and the FBI for alleged misuse of campaign funds. Now, Hunter has denied guilt, but he did repay over $60,000 to his campaign. Josh Buttner says he's running for Congress to put people first, not personal profit or special interest politics. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So, can you start by telling us what motivated you to jump into the campaign and run for Congress?
Well, that's a good question. I get asked that a lot. You know, I just really have this intense obligation to serve, and I retired in 2011 from the SEAL teams, and when I did that, I missed that sense of service that I had. And as you mentioned, you know, I come from a long line of men and women that have served. My grandfather met my grandmother during World War II.
Really?
Both in uniform. Yep. He was Army Air Corps and she was an Army nurse. And so, you know, I was raised with a strong sense of service and leadership, and those values were really instilled in me. And so when I retired to spend more time with my children, I missed that sense of service. And they grew up and flew the coop. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, my oldest son's in the Navy now, and mm-hmm. my middle son went to film school and is pursuing his dreams, and my daughter's at UC Santa Cruz. So I'm an empty nester. And that's exactly why I ran for school board. And I'm honored to have been elected as a trustee. And now I get to basically champion a cause that's near and dear to my heart, which is public education. And I get that sense of service.
We're going to be talking about education and all of those important issues on today's show. First, Josh, I'd like to ask you what you consider the most important issues in this campaign, or what your priorities are if you're elected to be our next congressman.
Well, as you mentioned, education is obviously one of my priorities. And at serving on the school board and seeing the front lines of the impacts of not properly funding education has just cemented my views on the fact that we need to make education a higher priority, make public education and proper funding a higher priority, and we're not doing that. Even in the state, at the state level,
yeah.
We are, as you know probably, we're the sixth largest economy in the world, California is.
Yes.
Just above France and just below the UK. But our funding level is at the 41st level amongst the states. Now, that might get changed a little bit with the new budget that came out, and I know that they've brought us back to just under 2008 levels. So
wow.
We haven't even reached post the recession. That was at the state level. And now what you see with the Trump administration is basically what I consider an attack on public education, and taking those public funds and the voucher program that they claim is, you know, the ability to spread that money in a manner that the states find easier to manage, really is an opportunity to take that money out of public funded education and put it into privately funded charter schools, if you will, that don't have boards that are elected by your constituents and your members of your society, but they're run by CEOs.
Very troubling. And this, of course, is one of the initiatives being spearheaded by Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, who Trump appointed. She was very involved with her husband in promoting charter schools, and I think she actually had one herself that she touted or was involved in, and it was found to be a failing school. I think it was eventually shut down or barred from getting funds. That doesn't really seem like the model that we want to be emulating for
our children across America. But you're right. Even if it's a successful charter school academically, it still takes money. It takes that average daily attendance money out of the public school, and it's sending it into private schools where we really don't know what's going on. We don't know what standards are being met or not met. We don't know exactly what they're teaching the kids on some of the different controversial issues. So it can be very problematic.
Yeah, that's all true. But what's also very problematic is that those schools may look like they're performing well, but they're also able to cherry pick, if you will, their students. And what happens is those schools don't necessarily get started in what we might consider the worst neighborhoods or the neighborhoods of greatest need, but actually get started in the neighborhoods of affluence because that's where the money is. And those schools are making money, and that's why they're in the business.
So the rich areas get better and better schools, and the poor areas get worse and worse schools. And also, I would think that there could be a big impact on disabled students.
That's right. And what's great about having public funds go to a public education system is that we're required by law to treat everybody equally. And if you have a student with special needs, you're required to accommodate that student's needs,
right,
which my school district is quite small, and that can be quite impactful, but it's required by law. And so we do the best with what we can. And the more funds that we have to take care of those students, the better. Mm-hmm. And if you're removing funds and allowing them to go to students that already have it pretty good, then you're compounding the problem.
Yeah, we really see an amazing impact on the lives of some of these disabled students because
Absolutely.
Of that money, and that would be lost under the policies that they're trying to put forth at the federal level, which I might add are policies that Congressman Hunter has supported. He's all for charter schools and vouchers and taking money out of public education.
That's right. And another thing he did was co-sponsor a bill that would withhold federal funds from any California state school at the university level that indicated that they were a sanctuary school.
Yeah.
But the whole point of that was that we just didn't want immigration enforcement happening on school campus, and to withhold federal funding from your state schools in your district is harming students, not helping them, and it's the exact opposite of what I would do.
Yeah, that's a very serious concern there. On charter schools, Josh, can you clarify for listeners, are you talking about funding for public charter schools such as Helix and Steel Canyon, which actually have very good reputations here in the Grossmont Union High School District, or are you talking about private charter schools sucking money out of the public school system?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that's a common misconception. I'm absolutely talking about private charter schools. So my daughter even went to the Hamul Dulzura Charter School, which is public and has a elected officials as their board, where I sit now. And that's completely different than the private schools that don't have to follow all state laws. And those public schools are quite great, and those public charter schools are quite great. And my daughter's at University of California, Santa Cruz right now, and her elementary education did her just fine.
Good for her. My kids were both products of public schools, and
yeah,
so was I.
Me too.
Another serious concern from voters, of course, right now is health care. Can you bring us up to speed on some of the latest developments on this health care bill that the Republicans are putting forward? And then I'd like to hear your views about, I guess, the pros and cons of all the different things. There's certainly pros and cons of Obamacare, but then we've seen the Republicans attempt to repeal and replace it with something that, according to the Congressional Budget Office, would kick 23 million people off of health care and get rid of protections for those with pre-existing conditions, cut Medicaid. So in a lot of ways, that seemed worse. They didn't have the votes for that. And the latest we're hearing as of this week is they're now talking about just repealing Obamacare completely and replacing it with absolutely nothing. So
what
do you think about all of this?
Well, you've summed it up quite well where we're at. When the bill that was passed by the House kicked 23 million people off of health care. And then the bill that finally died in the Senate was just going to kick 20 million off of healthcare.
Yeah, but have even deeper cuts in Medicaid, so.
True. And, I think, and what I've been, championing, from the very beginning is, while the Affordable Care Act may have some deficiencies, of course, it's a very large program, that is new, was implemented, and needs to be constantly tweaked to be fixed. It was a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And we should be looking at, okay, how can we best help Americans? And what I see going on right now is just a partisan fight and right. trying to score points on the backs of these Americans. And what we should be doing is taking every step possible, even if it's a small step, to make healthcare more affordable, more accessible, and better if we can.
And that's what Donald Trump promised to do, but he certainly has not succeeded in that.
It is what he promised, and it's what we should remember is the focus of what our legislators should be doing, and that is taking care of the people that they're there to represent. Yeah. And I don't think that's happening right now.
Congressman Hunter, during his town hall meeting that we covered, was asked about the health care issue, and he stated that he does not believe health care should be a right, that it should be, it's a privilege, basically, not a right. What are your views on that?
Yeah, and I disagree, and there's some other congressmen that have tried to make that argument, and I think it's flawed logic in that just because I'm claiming it's a right doesn't mean that I'm putting somebody else in a position where they have to take care of me. Mm-hmm. The point is that we have one of the most innovative and advanced countries in the world, and we have the ability to take care of our citizens in a much better way than we are right now. And when it comes to healthcare, water, and energy, we have an obligation to do so. And I do think healthcare is a right. And not to mention the fact that Americans have been paying into a tax system that pays for Medicare and Medicaid for many, many years.
Correct.
And
it's not an entitlement. We've all paid for this.
That's right. We've all paid for it. And now is not the time when those that go to use it need it the most that we cut it out from underneath them, especially when they're at their most vulnerable.
Yeah.
So.
And by the way, we should mention, listeners, for those of you that may not have heard this, the Congressional Budget Office, which is, of course, nonpartisan, their analysis included a look at what would happen if Obamacare were just repealed with no replacement. And it's actually even worse. That would kick 30 million Americans off of healthcare completely and double premiums for all Americans on average. Whether you're on Obamacare or not, or private insurance, the average person would be paying twice as much if that were to happen.
And I'm glad you brought that up again, because what that shows you is that with all of this partisan fighting mm-hmm. is they're sending shockwaves into the insurance industry. And so they're actually making it worse
yeah.
by their inaction and their starts and sputters. If they got together and worked together across mm-hmm. the aisle, which is what I've been advocating from the very beginning.
And they've shut the Democrats out. They've refused to even allow them in any of these
right.
negotiations.
Or even debate it in public. So yeah. nobody knows what's going on.
Right.
So the insurance industry doesn't know how to even react. So they're pulling out in many ways. And if you look at states that expanded Medicaid and took advantage of the expansion, they're doing better and their rates are lower and they have more providers
like
because
California.
There's funds to like California. Mm-hmm. And so we need to keep expanding the capability to take care of our Americans.
And interestingly, you mentioned the insurance industry. The CEOs of the major insurance companies have come out against the Republican plan that just failed. And so has the American Medical Association, which represents doctors, the Nurses Association, the AARP representing retirees. There's a very, very, very long list of everybody that opposes this. And it's pretty much every patient advocacy group that you can imagine, every medical professional, every insurance group that you can imagine. I don't know who's in favor of it other than the president and some of the most conservative members of Congress.
And I'd like to draw a parallel to defense funding. And what you're seeing in medical care is that businesses need some type of, they like stability
yeah.
because they can plan. And what we're seeing is these spikes and dips. And nobody knows how to react to that. And so they withdraw and the problem gets worse. The same things happened in the defense industry when the government was shut down. That caused lots of pain within that industry and cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And we haven't recovered some of that yet. It takes a long time to get that capacity back up.
Listeners, if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Josh Buttner, a Democratic candidate running for the 50th Congressional District. This is the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Let's talk about military issues a little bit. Now, of course, your opponent, Congressman Duncan Hunter, is a military veteran. He did serve in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we certainly all thank him for his service. That said, do you believe that he has done enough to try to fight for the needs of military personnel and their families, as well as veterans? Are there areas you agree with him on in that realm, perhaps? Or are there areas that you disagree where you would do something differently?
Well, I think we all as Americans owe a great debt to veterans. And mm-hmm. I don't want that to be too self-serving, being a veteran myself. But what, from my experiences, what I've seen is those that suffer the most really are the families. I have a picture of my mother holding me as a tiny little baby. And the thought that always hits my mind is that her grandfather served, and there was a time when her father was overseas. And in that picture, when she's holding me, my father is in Vietnam. And then when I grew up, I served for 23 years and was gone probably overseas for half of that. And now my child is getting ready to deploy. And I didn't really think about it until I got out and realized that without that family core supporting our veterans, you can't have that warrior out there.
Right.
And so we really need to take care of those families, especially the active duty member families. That needs to be a priority for our care for veterans. And then also when they've gotten out of the service, then it's time to look towards those veterans and ensure that we can, if they're having trouble, we can house them when they're in need and then help them with job training, work education and development, which we can talk about some more later in a broader sense. But obviously veterans, not everything translates over that easily to the civilian world.
Right.
And they've spent a long time learning their skills. They're highly capable people. They don't always have the skills that translate easily. We can fix that. It's a matter of training. We should look towards that.
Yeah. Congressman Hunter, like his father before him, serves on the House Armed Services Committee, so certainly has a voice in a lot of military matters, and intelligence, you know, information and so forth. I would like to know what your views are on foreign policy, if you believe that there are areas where you differ with his views, and if so, what those are, particularly, I guess, with the handling of everything in the Middle East that's in such turmoil right now.
So one area is, I believe when we look at national security and our foreign defense, we need to focus on all the aspects of power that we bring. And we like to use acronyms in the military. So one I like to use is DIME. And that stands for diplomacy. It stands for intelligence, military, obviously, but also economic power. We need to leverage all of those to keep our nation secure. And it was even General Mattis that said, hey, if you take away foreign investment, you might as well buy bullets with that money, because now I'm going to have to fight the people that I was maybe going to be able to not have to engage in some type of confrontation. So we need to be leaders. We need to be leaders abroad. We need to invest in not only the United States, but we also need to invest in our partners and our emerging partners.
Which isn't really happening right now. We're seeing cuts in a lot of those areas under the current administration.
Yes, absolutely, especially in the State Department. I think that's a big mistake. Also, those are the people with the most knowledge about these foreign areas, and we should retain that knowledge and use it to the best of our ability.
Speaking of foreign powers, it's been much in the news about the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, looking into very serious allegations about the Trump administration, or rather the Trump campaign, having close ties to Russia and perhaps even having knowledge of or encouraging Russian interference in the U.S. election in a variety of means. What are your views about that, and how concerned do you think the American public should be about all of this?
We should all be concerned. From day one, I've thought this is a very serious matter. It's a known technique for Russians and some other adversaries to use misinformation. We used to call it propaganda in the Cold War, and it was maybe on a poster or coming over the radio waves.
Fake news.
Fake news. But the fact of the matter is, misinformation is a key tool in information warfare, and it's just able to be more effective now in the digital time that we're in. And there is no doubt now, we all know, and publicly, and the administration has stated that In fact, the Russians did penetrate our networks and use that information to mislead the American people. And so from day one, I've asked for an independent investigation. It's happening now. I've been a champion of that. We need to let that play out unimpeded to its fullest extent, as ugly as it gets. I know there's a lot of Russian investigation fatigue out there, and that's unfortunate that we're in this position.
Congressman Hunter, we should add, has been a staunch supporter of Donald Trump from the very beginning, one of the earliest in supporters during the campaign, and has continued to stand by him and be defensive of him. And at least as of when he had his town hall in Ramona, he was opposed to an independent counsel investigation. Of course, there's a lot of new information. We haven't talked to him since then. But, I mean, do you think that that's kind of putting blinders on?
Yeah, I was at that town hall, and frankly, I'm quite confused by that. One, I think he was quite tone deaf to the audience there, and what I saw was a representative that had grown arrogant and just appeared not to be listening or concerned about his constituents. But also, he's one of the congressmen that said, hey, we should cozy up to the Russians even more. This could be a good thing for the United States, and I just don't see it.
And he's certainly been very silent in the wake of the most recent revelations, most recently, of course, Donald Trump, for a year, for months, has insisted that his campaign didn't have any meetings with Russia. They had no ties to Russia. In no way were they involved in Russia trying to influence the election. And we now know that Donald Trump Jr. set up a meeting with a Russian government lawyer under the promise that she was going to deliver damaging information about Hillary Clinton, that there was a former Russian counterintelligence agent in that meeting, and that he lied initially and said it was about adoptions, and then he lied about who was in the meeting, and well, then it was two people and three people and four people. Now we found out there are eight people who were in the meeting and at least two others who were listening in by a phone call.
That's right.
We know
the Russian clown car. Yeah,
yeah. I think, so this is certainly not no contact. How could anybody just forget a meeting like that?
That's right. And I think what he's seeing now is the story unravel. He, being Duncan Hunter, is seeing the story unravel, and he wants no part of it. And but we all know that he was a champion of this administration, and basically of the and willing to believe those lies. And I think it just represents a lack of critical thinking on his part. And I don't know if it's because he was putting party over country, which we should always put country over party.
I mean, that's a good question. If the situation were reversed and you're a Democrat, if there were
that's
a Democratic president and you saw this going on, what would you do?
I would say the same thing. We need an independent investigation and find out the full extent of what happened. And then we'll take appropriate action after that. But I wouldn't make excuses for those leaders that have shown what I consider to be poor judgment at the minimum.
Yeah. I mean, the latest today is that we're hearing that at the G8, the international summit that they just had, that President Trump went off and had a private, some say 1 hour meeting with Vladimir Putin, the Russian dictator, and that there was no American president, just him, Putin, and a Russian translator.
Correct.
Is that unprecedented?
It's somewhat unprecedented. Normally, there's somebody taking notes, especially for a meeting that long. But what's more concerning to me is it's part of a pattern that we've seen from this administration and their willingness to be extremely close to Russia. And I don't know what the motivation is, and I think that's what the investigation will find out.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly moving forward. Your opponent, Congressman Hunter, is facing some very serious federal charges. He's actually, as we mentioned, under investigation by the U.S. Justice Department and by the FBI for allegations that he expended some very lavish sums of money on personal uses. This included things like money on his children's school, money for a European vacation in Italy over Thanksgiving weekend with his family, very high-end jewelry stores, some others.
Right. So I think what you see is the breaking of trust between government and the constituents. And what you have on one hand is you have a career politician, and on the other hand, you have a citizen who's just fed up with the way things are working in Washington and wants to rebuild that trust between our citizens and our government. And that's what I'm running to do. I think that Congressmen should hold themselves to a higher ethical standard than if they were a private citizen, and I plan to do just that.
Let's talk about some of the other hot issues of the election. What are your views on immigration and border security, and I should add also on the mass deportations that we're now seeing under the Trump administration?
So I think we absolutely need comprehensive immigration reform, because those people that are in the United States illegally fall outside of our protection and also fall outside of our ability to benefit from their labor in a positive way and benefit from their tax base. And what we've seen here in California is actually a mass migration in the opposite direction. I think we've lost 140,000 net over the last 10 years going south. So not that we don't have an illegal immigration problem. We do. We still have a large number of illegal immigrants. And that's where our immigration policy, humanely conducted, could take care of those people in a humane way and still have a feasible program that allows for responsible immigration into the United States. Mm-hmm. But building a $64 billion to $70 billion mass wall on the border that reminds me of something like the Maginot Line, which was built in France to keep the Germans out and was completely ineffective right at the day it was completed,
right,
or even started, is not the way to go. And it's taking funds from things that actually keep us safer, like Border Patrol agents, like new equipment and communications for those agents, and for the Coast Guard as well.
Maybe counterterrorism operations.
Absolutely. So we have really smart layered defenses and protections for our country that we should be investing in, not a 19th century wall.
Okay. Donald Trump ran for election promising to make America great again and bring back American jobs from overseas. What are your views about what should be done to try to improve the economy, trade, I'll throw in there, and to create more jobs? And I would say not just more jobs, but good-paying jobs that can support a middle-class family.
So earlier we were talking, I work at a company called Aqualung, which is a dive equipment manufacturing company founded by Jacques Cousteau.
And, that must have been fascinating work. You were a diver than being a Navy SEAL.
Right. It was a good fit for me, and I've enjoyed that work. And I was actually able to win a contract with the U.S. Navy and bring some manufacturing to Vista, California.
Very good.
Where we're making some new equipment. But it's quite difficult to compete with the rest of the world with our labor rates as they are. And so the only way to really do that is to be innovative. And that's how we won that contract. We created a new piece of equipment that allowed the U.S. Navy to have new capabilities. We innovated. And some of the ways to do that are to be forward-looking. For example, in energy, you know, keeping up coal miner jobs. I think there's less coal mine jobs than there are people working at Carl's Jr., I heard recently.
Yeah.
And so, and that's not leading innovation either, not to mention the damage that we already know coal, burning coal and fossil fuels does to our environment. And from some statistics that I saw, it takes about 40% funding and infusion from the government of money to make oil profitable at $50 a barrel. And it's, and now oil's dropped from that. It's a little bit less. And so why don't we take that 40% funds and push those over to renewable energies? And you could do it, you could even do it in a methodical process so that there's little damage to the jobs that exist right now.
Right.
As you build up the infrastructure and the job base in these innovative areas, which are the future. And the United States, in my vision, has always led the way in innovation.
Yeah.
And innovation is what, look at Apple, it's the largest company in the world.
Definitely.
It's based on innovation. It's not based on old technology. It's based on forward-looking technology.
What would it take to get some of those innovative companies out here in East County, where we have places like El Cajon that has the highest poverty rate in San Diego County, or tied with Escondido, and where we have especially a lot of the refugees and immigrants in the Chaldean community,
yeah,
for example, where I think they have 50 or 60% unemployment rate among some of those groups.
And that's a fantastic workforce that's just waiting. When I look at El Cajon and when I look at Escondido, mm-hmm. I see these communities that are just ripe for development
yeah.
because they're nice places to live, but they have high poverty because they have a lot of immigrants that have just come to the country. And mm-hmm. what we can do is workforce education and development. And I've heard the term now blue steam, which is, we all know science, technology, and now they've added A for art. And so we have STEAM,
yeah.
Mathematics and engineering. And now blue collar jobs require those kinds of skill sets.
Right.
And so the recent immigrants, they just need language. These people were engineers and doctors, and now they're mm-hmm. Working at a lower wage job. Only because of their language skills. And so we get their language skills up and you have this huge base of employees that can be skilled employees rapidly within 1 to 2 years. You could have a skilled employee base.
So
and you just need to bring the jobs to
trying
home.
To bring another Walmart or Home Depot or something to East yeah. County, which seems to often be the focus when, you know, when they're looking at what can they bring in jobs. Maybe instead try to bring in some of these, blue steam type companies so
Absolutely.
That once people are trained, they wouldn't have to drive halfway across the county for a job. There could maybe be companies out here in East County that could employ them.
Absolutely. And we can build those in those urban centers. We do have some urban centers in East County,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've talked about where they are. And also you can build corridors of public transit, and we're seeing some of it go out into Santee. We have the trolley that's made it out into
yeah.
Santee. We need more of that so that we can reduce that traffic and that requirement to commute.
I would like to ask your views about some other issues where Congressman Hunter's views have been somewhat controversial, such as women's issues, gay rights, civil rights. He at one point had co-authored a bill that would declare life begins at conception, which would mean no abortion, even if your life was in danger, even if you were raped or an incest victim. He also was against repealing the don't ask, don't tell policy in the military, to just name a few of those
yes.
issues.
So some of those policies that he's recommended I see as quite extreme. One, I think we should be fully funding Planned Parenthood, and mm-hmm. if you look at studies, it actually reduces the numbers of abortions.
I was just going to ask, for those pro-life listeners who may be out there
mm-hmm.
who are concerned, certainly I think, you know, maybe rightfully concerned about mm-hmm. wanting to save babies,
Absolutely.
But there's also the woman's life to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
What are your views on ways to reduce abortions, at least those that are based on, say, financial need or some of these other things that would be preventable, if you don't want to outlaw them? Do you believe there are policies that can help encourage, you know, fewer abortions without taking away the right to one?
Absolutely. Again, education is a great aspect of mm-hmm. that. And also fully funding Planned Parenthood, because those types of clinics, they do many more things than just that.
Break
and they also serve those communities, especially in rural communities, that are most vulnerable and most in need. So we absolutely should be fully funding those types of clinics.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that, especially in those rural areas, sometimes a Planned Parenthood clinic is the only source for all health care, not just
That's
reproductive
right.
needs, but things like cancer screenings, and even some men go to them. I interviewed a
right.
gal who headed up a Planned Parenthood clinic in a rural area, and she said in their town it was the only medical
That's
place
right.
that you could go to.
That's right. And to get back to the military, you know, when that Don't Ask, Don't Tell first came out, I don't know about everybody else, but I didn't notice a change at all. And I don't care what your sexual orientation is. If you're in a foxhole next to me with a gun on my right and my left, and you're protecting me like I'm protecting you, that's all that matters.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we need to leave that.
There you go.
There's no further comments on that needed.
Wildfires. Wildfire season is upon us, and we're seeing massive cuts in the budget for the Federal Forest Service, including firefighting. Just this week, there's a new story out that they are restricting the massive air tankers that Boeing has come up with and saying you can only use it for a first attack on a wildfire and not after that. And we all know what happens when you don't get control of a California wildfire. If you were elected, what would you fight for in terms of better firefighting protection for our region, for that matter, all of the West?
Yeah, so I live out in the back country, as they say, and my valley hasn't burned in at least 30 years. So I'm quite concerned about this, and the valley over burned last year.
Yeah.
And so it's a concern for all of us. What we're now doing is paying about $147 a year more for the fires that were caused by SDG&E power poles.
Yeah.
So infrastructure is a big aspect of this. And if you remember the brownout in California about, was it 2-3 years ago? Which was caused by a power surge out in the desert.
Yuma, the three-state blackout.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the three-state blackout. Yeah.
I guess
it wasn't a brownout. It was a blackout. That's right. Mm-hmm. So what you're seeing is a lack of investment in some of the infrastructure. And so, to protect us both from wildfires and from, our power structure causing those wildfires, we need to invest in that infrastructure. I'm happy living in the backcountry. I'm happy to pay a little bit extra for the fire department to be out there and for the Forest Service to help us. But there's no reason why we can't fully fund the Forest Service to help manage those forests in the best way. And we have to acknowledge the fact that climate change is causing some of these problems, and it's just going to get worse. And so if you just acknowledge the reality and address the problem up front.
Start to work to roll back climate change, then maybe that would help
reduce the
severity and the number of these extreme fires.
That's right, and that gets back to being innovative with energy, etc.
We're also reading this week that the Forest Service has so far been refusing to pay its bill to CAL FIRE and local governments for firefighting, and it's gone on so long now that CAL FIRE is threatening to stop fighting fires on federal forest lands like Cleveland National Forest if they can't get this bill paid. What would you do about that if you were elected to Congress?
Well, obviously, this is where the state needs to work well with Congress, needs to work well with the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government should allow the states to act in a manner, they should support the states in the way that they act.
I haven't seen, I'm on his press release list, I haven't seen anything from Congressman Hunter's office about this, and yet it seems to be a pretty severe threat to a lot of areas in his district.
And that's a job for a congressman to listen to his constituents and stand up for them in Congress, and I do just that.
I'd like to ask you if you can tell us a little bit about how your campaign is going, any major endorsements you've picked up, and it's certainly one factor, how much money you've raised and maybe who your major sources of funding are.
Yeah, so I'm very excited. The campaign's going very well. Yeah, we've been real successful. We've raised about $141,000, just shy of the incumbent, but we have, I think of all the candidates, we have the most cash on hand. We run a very disciplined program here, and so we don't spend lavishly. So we're preparing our war chest for later on. I was recently endorsed by Congressman Seth Moulton, a fellow veteran, and he's endorsed eight candidates across the country, mm-hmm. and I was happy to be one of them. I also have an endorsement from Congressman Pete Aguilar, just a little ways up the hill here from us here in San Diego County, and I hope have the Unite Here Local 30 endorsement. Also have the endorsement of Vote Vets, and you can go to votevets.com and read about that.
Very good.
I'm very excited about really all of the support I've gotten across the county.
Mm-hmm.
This is really a grassroots campaign, and those are the majority of my donors. And it's been a lot of work. We have a very geographically diverse and broad county, as you know.
Huge district. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of coffees and town halls and explaining why I'm running and talking to a lot of folks. And they've been very supportive of my campaign.
Are you concerned about the growing corporate influence on campaign and the massive amounts of PAC money and dark money that's going into election campaigns?
I'm extremely concerned, and I see that as a possible threat to democracy. And Citizens United, obviously, we all know, led to unlimited funding coming into our campaigns.
Right, the big Supreme Court decision.
That's right. And now having to live with that decision, being on the end of having to raise money mm-hmm. at a grassroots level, knowing that there's a possibility that at the last minute, money could come in from who knows where and influence an election. Maybe it might come from Russia because it can't be tracked. It's just a terrible thing for our democracy, and I think it's a threat. And so I would like to initiate a bill to propose that we have public funding, frankly, at the congressional level. As you know, congressmen only serve for 2 years, and the reason for that is to keep you very close to your constituents. So if you begin to veer away from them and not represent them, you can be recalled and rejected, and they can put somebody else in who will then represent the district, and that's a good thing. But if you have congressmen trying to raise money every 2 years, and they start a year out, then they're raising more money than they are representing their district, and that's a problem.
Yeah, it does become a vicious cycle. So let me ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. I'm asking all the candidates this, but what makes you think that you're tough enough to beat not only 5 other Democrats in the race, but Congressman Duncan Hunter, if you make it to the general election, or whoever the Republicans put up, if by chance he's been, you know, indicted or stepped down by then over these scandals, and if you're elected, to stand up to all that special interest money in Washington, D.C.?
So what I like to tell people is don't confuse civility with weakness, for one.
You're a Navy SEAL. You don't get into that occupation unless you're a pretty tough guy, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Do you think that your experience as a Navy SEAL has helped toughen you up, so to speak, to withstand the pressures in Washington, D.C.?
Sure. What I've learned in the SEAL teams is that we work together as a team, and there are lots of opportunities to face situations that may seem insurmountable. But as a SEAL, there's a couple of things about us. One, we just need to see a way. There just has to be a possibility, and we don't like to lose.
Okay. Well, those are very important character traits. Listeners, if you've just tuned in, we've been speaking with Josh Buttner, a former lieutenant commander in the Navy SEALs and current member of the Hummel-Dulzura School Board, who is running for Congress as a Democrat against Congressman Duncan Hunter in the 50th Congressional District. Josh, if people want to get more information about your campaign, where can they find out more?
Thank you. Yeah, you can go to joshbuttnerforcongress.com, all one word, just spelled out.
B-U-T-N-E-R.
B-U-T-N-E-R. And there you can find out a little bit about my background and also some latest press releases and how well we're doing in the race, and it's looking good. And so I encourage you to go there.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Miriam Raftery with an update on the Lost Fire, which started Saturday at the Indian Flats campground off of Highway 79 near Warner Springs. The fire forced evacuation of the campground, as well as prompting an evacuation advisory for the Chihuahua Valley Road area. The blaze also impacted the Pacific Crest Trail. The Lost Fire charred over 250 acres so far, but firefighters from CAL FIRE and the National Forest Service have made good progress battling the blaze. The evacuation advisory for Chihuahua Valley Road has been lifted and the shelter closed. As of Sunday night, when this show is being taped, the fire is 40% contained.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.